So we come back to 2 Samuel, and we've reached chapter 19. If you remember last time we were here, we had the defeat of Absalom's rebellion, and we had the death of Absalom. And now we reach a turning point. The rebellion is over, Absalom is dead, the rebel army has been defeated, but David isn't actually back in Jerusalem. He's not reigning over Israel at the moment. David can't simply assume the throne because he has a problem. The reason that the rebellion came so close to succeeding was because Absalom actually had the support of the people. You remember back in chapter 15, we were reading how Absalom was sitting in the gate. Absalom was winning the hearts of the people over to him. And these are the people who've actively rejected their king. This wasn't Absalom assuming the throne against the will of the people. What he did with the will of the people behind him. I mean, if you turn back to chapter 15 for a moment. Chapter 15 and verse 3, we are told that the hearts of all the people were with Absalom. So, what's David going to do at this point? Well, let's read our passage for this evening and we'll find out. Chapter 19, and we're going to start reading in verse 9. To Samuel chapter 19, verse 9. All the people were in a dispute throughout the tribes of Israel, saying, "The king saved us from the hand of our enemies. He delivered us from the hand of the Philistines. And now he has fled from the land because of Absalom. But Absalom, who we anointed over us, has died in battle. Now therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing back the king?" So they wanted to bring back the king, but some of them rejected the idea. Some of them were no doubt concerned. If you've been conspiring against the king, what's he going to do to you when he gets back? So they would. There were some here that doubted. So what's David going to do? Well, verse 11, David sent to Zadok and Abiathar the priest, saying, "Speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house? Seeing the word of all Israel has come to the king, to his very house. You are my brethren, you are my bone and my flesh. Why then are you the last to bring back the king? And say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so to me and more also, if you are not commander of the army before me continually in the place of Joab." So he swayed the hearts of all the men of Judah, just as the heart of one man, so that they sent this word to the king: "Return, you and all your servants." So the king returned and came to the Jordan. And Judah came to Gilgal to go to meet the king, to escort the king across the Jordan. And Shimei, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, who was from Bahurim, hurried and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. There were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and his 20 servants were with him. And they went over the Jordan before the king. Then a ferry boat went across to carry the king's household and to do what he thought good. So what do we have here? There was no obvious candidate to unite the nation except David. And it seems the majority of the tribes here were in favour of bringing him back. But those of Judah, who would have been foremost in the rebellion against David, were making objections. And of course, this was a personal conflict for them. This was a fight within David's family. So David moves things along. We know he has this means of communicating with the priests in Jerusalem. So he asks the priests to speak to the elders. He reminds them of his family relationship with them. You are my bone and my flesh. Why are you the last ones to bring the king back? So what's David doing here? He's seeking to allay the fears the people may have had, to demonstrate that he doesn't harbour any resentment. He's not bearing any grudges towards the elders of the people because of their complicity in the plot against him. He reminds them that he is closely related to them and that he's ready to forgive them. But it's not just the people here, is it? Verse 13, he speaks directly to Amasa, the commander of the rebel army. He was the one who fought against David, the one who orchestrated the battle to defeat the king. And if anyone's going to expect some kind of retaliation here, it's going to be him, isn't it? And yet David holds out the olive branch here. He reminds Amasa that they are in fact closely related. Amasa is probably David's nephew. And he offers to make Amasa commander of the new army. Now what's David thinking about here? Well, in some ways it seems like an astute political move, doesn't it? I mean, he takes the command of the rebel army and makes them his own commander. So he's uniting the two armies together. Any remaining soldiers who would be loyal to the rebellion, to Absalom, will come with him. Otherwise, they would have been seeking to stoke rebellion against him, wouldn't they? But David probably sees another way, another problem here he's trying to get rid of. He's trying to deal with the Joab problem, isn't he? I mean, Joab was loyal to David, there's no doubt, but David has continual problems with Joab, acting against him. And David may well be suspicious about what just happened to Absalom as well. I mean, David had given Joab specific instructions, Absalom was to be unharmed, and yet what's happened there? Absalom is dead. I mean, David understood exactly how Joab operates and may at least have had some suspicions about this. I think this is the last of a long line of offences by Joab, including the commander of Saul's army who Joab had killed off. And Joab now sees an opportunity to rid himself of Joab once and for all. Remove his cousin Joab and put Amasa, a man who's proved his own military prowess, in his place. What David may not have realised here is he's actually placing Amasa in danger. And that's something we'll probably get to another time. But as we find out, up to this point, the plan is working. We read in verse 14 that he swayed the hearts of all the men of Judah. And they sent word to bring back the king. So, verse 15, David starts his journey home. The king returned and came to the Jordan. And Judah came to Gilgal to meet the king, to escort the king across the Jordan. They came to conduct the king back in triumph. Now Gilgal is by itself a fairly famous city in Israel, isn't it? Has some historical significance. Israel came to Gilgal. And where the elders of Israel last come here as a group? When they entered the Promised Land. It was here that Joshua set up the 12 stones from the Jordan. The 12 stones that were to serve as a permanent reminder to the 12 tribes. They were to serve and worship God alone. So here, this is a fitting location for Israel to welcome back God's anointed king. And to be reminded again, as a nation, of their commitment to serve the Lord. So as he comes back into Israel, what's David met with? He's met with a succession of people who want to entreat his forgiveness, his favour. Now, first of all, verse 17, who do we meet? We meet Ziba, the former servant of Saul. Ziba's in quite a hurry to meet David, isn't he? Now, why might that be? And he doesn't come alone. He comes with 1,000 men of Benjamin. He's 15 sons, 20 servants, and 1,000 men with him. And they're very, very keen to serve David, to do whatever he wanted. Why did Ziba want to be the first one to meet David? Well, Ziba's not telling us, but we do get a hint slightly later on. Because who comes after Ziba? Verse 24, it's Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, comes down to meet the king. And what state is Mephibosheth in? We're told he hadn't cared for his feet, or trimmed his moustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until he returned in peace. Now, what did Ziba tell us about Mephibosheth? If we turn back to chapter 16, verses 1 to 4, we meet Ziba the first time as David was leaving Israel. Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him saddled with a couple of donkeys, and on him 200 loaves of bread, 100 clusters of raisins, 100 summer fruits, skin of wine. Now, what did Ziba say to the king about Mephibosheth? He said, verse 3, he is staying in Jerusalem, for he said, today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me. So the king said to Ziba, here, all that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours. So Ziba's played this game before, turning up for the king with gifts, because he wants something from him. And now the king's returning in triumph, and Ziba has a problem, because now Mephibosheth turns up and gives the king quite a different story. David can see for himself that Ziba has lied to him. And the only reason Mephibosheth hadn't gone with the king when he left Jerusalem was because he was physically unable to do so. So Ziba obtained his inheritance from the king by deceit. So what's the plan here? Meet the king as soon as he comes in and do whatever you can for him so that you might earn some favour with him. So how does David act when Mephibosheth tells him why he didn't go with him? Well, he makes a proclamation, doesn't he? He says that he's going to, that they should divide the inheritance. Previously, it was Mephibosheth, then David gave it to Ziba, and now he's saying he wants them to divide it. But verse 30, how does Mephibosheth respond to that? He says to the king, let Ziba take it all, inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house. Mephibosheth is so grateful to have David back with him that he's prepared to surrender the land entirely just because, as long as David comes back safely. So this pronouncement of David has acted like a test. It was a way for him to discern whether the true loyalties of Mephibosheth lied. Mephibosheth has proved that he was truly loyal to the king and wasn't just thinking of what he could get out of him. Now, does this test remind you of anything? It reminds me a little here of what David's son would later employ when faced with two people making competing claims. In that case, it was Solomon who proposed dividing the baby. And by that stratagem, he worked out which one was the true mother. And I was wondering whether Solomon might have had this situation in mind when he gave the order, perhaps. You work out what the people truly want by offering to divide it. So who else does David meet on his way back? David meets Shimei, another man who feels in need to come and see the king as soon as he gets back into Israel. Now, what did Shimei do? Well, chapter 16, Shimei met David as he was leaving, and he was cursing David and throwing stones at him. And if you remember back at that time, Abishai wanted to have Shimei killed, and would have done so if David hadn't restrained him. But now David was returned victorious, and Shimei is rushing down to Gilgal to meet the king at the earliest opportunity again and ask his pardon for his ill treatment of him. He admits his actions were wrong, and he makes public submission to David. Now, at this point, what does Abishai say again? Let me kill him again. That seems to be the standard response to everything, at least from Joab and his family. Now, this is the interesting. How does Shimei refer to himself? If we read verse 20, Shimei says, "For I, your servant, know that I have sinned. Therefore, here I am, the first to come today of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet my lord the king." Now, Shimei was a Benjamite. Why does he refer to himself as the house of David, house of Joseph? What was he trying to say? Well, perhaps he's referring back to Genesis, making an application of his own case to the situation in which David now found himself. In Genesis, you remember that the brothers of Joseph mistreated him. But when they meet again, Joseph is willing to forgive them. And was that what was on Shimei's mind as he pleaded before the king for forgiveness for the wrong that he and the rest of his brothers in Israel had done? Now, David promises to keep Shimei alive. And he does, for as long as his reign lasts. But for now, David is gracious. He accepts the repentance of Shimei and lets him live. In fact, he acts the part of Joseph, doesn't he? David does it because he's gracious, but there were also political reasons for this. I mean, if the first person to approach David asking for forgiveness had been killed, that's not going to encourage the rest of the people to submit to him, is it? They'd be thinking they're better off continuing the rebellion and fighting for their lives. Now, some people actually think that Abishai was willing to kill Shimei at this point because he wanted to prolong the rebellion. It keeps people in their powerful army posts a bit longer, doesn't it? But, however, David decides to be gracious. Now, verse 31... we meet the next person, and this person isn't asking for forgiveness. We meet Barzillai the Gileadite, comes down from Rogelim and went across the Jordan with the king to escort him across the Jordan. Now you read in verse 31-32 that Barzillai was a very aged man, 80 years old, and he had provided the king with supplies while he stayed at Mahanaim, for he was a very rich man. And the king said to Barzillai, "Come across with me. I will provide for you while you are with me in Jerusalem." But Barzillai said to the king, "How long do I have to live that I should go with the king to Jerusalem? I am today 80 years old. Can I discern between the good and the bad? Can your servant taste what I eat or what I drink? Can I hear any longer the voice of singing men and singing women? Why then should your servant be a further burden to my lord the king? Your servant will go a little way across the Jordan with the king. And why should the king repay me with such a reward? Please let your servant turn back now that I may die in my own city, near the grave of my father and my mother. But here is your servant Chinam. Let him cross over with my lord the king and do for him what seems good to you." So the king answered, "Chinam, you'll cross over with me, and I will do for him what seems good to you. Now, whatever you request of me, I will do for you." Then all the people went over the Jordan. And when the king had crossed over, the king kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his own place. Now, David wants to do something for Uzziah, but does Elijah return for what he did for the king? He wants to take him to Jerusalem and keep him in comfort for the rest of his days. But Barzillai isn't keen on the proposal. He pleads his great age and says that an old man such as he isn't capable of enjoying life in the palace. Instead of going himself, Barzillai suggests that David could take Chinam, probably Barzillai's son, in his place. So after crossing the Jordan with him, Barzillai returns to his own city of Rogelim, and David and his party continue on to Jerusalem. Now it seems that David did keep his word here, but we do read later on of a place near Bethlehem called Geirath Chinam, meaning the abode of Chinam. So it looks like David actually made Chinam some kind of land grant from his own lands in Bethlehem later on. But what can we learn from this passage? It's a succession of people meeting David and asking for forgiveness. It's an interesting historical narrative, but there is quite a lot here. We can certainly learn from the behaviour of David at this point. He's returning to Jerusalem victorious, and it is within his power to do whatever he wishes to those who opposed him. And yet he chooses the path of mercy and forgiveness, even when it might be difficult for him. He understands that he's been forgiven much, and he's willing to show mercy where he can to these people. David is merciful, but he's not easily fooled. When Ziba comes along trying to ingratiate himself, David is willing to listen to the words of Mephibosheth and to test the loyalty of these people to see what they truly want from him. We can also learn from David's behaviour in regard to Barzillai how often we choose to forget those who've helped us along the way. We press forward, willing to take advantage when we can, and we forget those who've shown kindness to us. David was willing to do far more for Barzillai than Barzillai actually wanted him to do. But let's go back to Gilgal for a minute. When Joshua built that stone memorial on the bank of the Jordan, what was the point of it? Turn back to Joshua chapter 4 for a moment and we'll read that. Joshua chapter 4 verse 19. When the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they camped in Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And those 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. And he spoke to the children of Israel, saying, when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, what are these stones? Then you shall let your children know, saying, Israel crossed over this Jordan on dry land. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until you crossed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up before you until we had crossed over. That all the people on the earth may know that the hand of the Lord, which is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever. So, Gilgal was to serve as a reminder to the Israelites and the surrounding nations of the power of God. And those stones and that place would bring to their mind all that God had done for them in the past, and assure them that he had the power to do whatever he had promised for them in the future. And at Gilgal now we have God's anointed king who'd saved them from the hand of their enemies, returning to the land. A reminder to them and to us that all things are under the control of God, and things are working according to his plan. God knew in the purpose and eternity past when the reign of David would come to an end and who would succeed him. And in God's purposes, the throne of Israel was David's and would then pass to Solomon and not to Absalom. But there's something else this passage can remind us of, isn't there? We see David returning to the land as king and exercising mercy to his rebellious subjects. And can we not be reminded here that there is a time when God would send David's greatest son into the land to bring forgiveness to rebellious people? As Israel were now turning back to David and away from their rebellion, let us look to David's greater son and turn away from our rebellion and seek peace with him. Now the reign of David did come to an end, but by faith David was looking forward to the coming king who would set up a kingdom that would never end. And I want to finish now just by reading Psalm 2 to remind us of this kingdom. If we can just turn to Psalm 2 for a moment. Why do the nations rage? Why do the people plot a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision. Then he shall speak to them in his wrath and distress them in his deep displeasure. Yet I have set my king on his holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will give you the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Now therefore be wise, O kings. Be instructed, you judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are all those who put their trust in him. So David returns as king, but there came a greater king with a kingdom that will never end. And it's him that we must seek peace with.